This one time in Jordan, I ate eggplant. I had built in a day of touring ahead of a work conference in Amman. But I'm that guy who gets on a public bus to find some hidden gem suggested over a whiskey at the hotel bar. Sure, there are the days when that whiskey leads to a dud of a tourist trap, but then there are those days that dazzle. On a rickety trolley with my people, I arrived at a 1,400-year-old temple, well off the beaten trail. That sweaty, dusty, beaten trail. Man, the Middle East is hot. Once I was satisfied with my photographs of ruins with nary a soul to get in the way, I was famished. Which I realized was not a trivial problem way out in these sticks. Like R2 and 3PO before me, I forged across the sands, increasingly hungry. I passed by a rural elementary school as the final bell rang and was summarily mobbed by a dozen fourth graders just out of English class. "Hello, hello, nice to meet you too. Where can I get some food?" My new best friend, Ahmad, pointed to a tattered shack about 100 yards away. The kids went on their way, laughing as only school kids can. But, I wondered, what was so funny? So I approached this shack with my fingers crossed that this was not the joke. As I said pardon me to a camel, drew back the woolen wall, and entered the establishment, my jaw hit the floor. Imagine, if you will, walking into a 1960s Technicolor movie set of a desert oasis. This was it. Spurting fountains, vibrant carpets, polished silver everywhere, hookah clouds, and haughty laughter with every breath, all with a joyous tambourine soundtrack. This wasn't simply real life, this was the life. Oh, and I ordered the maklouba. My name is Howie Southworth. I travel, I eat, I cook, and then I write fancy words about all of it. My cookbooks are loaded with wild stories and fabulous bites, and I've shared plenty of my own adventures. But now, I want to hear somebody else's for a change. Sauced in Translation is a timely podcast spanning the globe of food, spinning tales of lavish meals, and epic gastronomic failure. Join us for some well-deserved armchair globetrotting. Let's get saucy. My guest today is Karis Vucek. Karis wears many, many hats professionally. Actor, director, producer, modern creator in the purest sense. Where I became familiar with her on the festival circuit through her award-winning female spy thriller, The Pepper Project, and the follow-up, Pepper Ricochet. You are most likely to know her from the Law and Order universe, in which she has played Louise Campisi since 2007. Not that her experience on and off stage and screen isn't phenomenal, but it's her Sicilian-Croatian lineage that piques my interest the most. With any luck, I'll get to the bottom of this gelato for breakfast thing once and for all. Here's our chat. Karis, you and I met in Vermont at ITV Fest around a bonfire talking with other creatives about, oh, I don't know, maple syrup, I assume. How weird is it to do the festival circuit without the bond of the bonfire?
First, let me say, Howie, thank you so much. I'm really, really excited to be chatting with you on your great show about such an interesting topic and things kind of off center of what we usually talk about around bonfires. I will say that it has been interesting and challenging and all sorts of things doing the festival circuit without seeing people and having it be live. For that reason, and I knew the experience was going to be quite different, when I submitted the sequel to The Pepper Project, Pepper Ricochet, to a lot of festivals last year pre-COVID, I ended up pulling out of most of them and resubmitting this year, or just tabling my official selection until this year, which the festival directors were so generous in accommodating me to do, because I do like that interaction. It's part of the reason why I love being in festivals. We met that way, talking about maple syrup and many other things, probably, so around a bonfire with all those other wonderful creators that we met. And had we not had those opportunities to meet in person, there would be something that was really lost. So I did participate a few last year in the summer, which was great. I thought people did a wonderful job with the platforms. And I just participated in, I would say, this was dynamite, I have to say. I'm going to tip my hat to the DC Web Fest. Otessa Kantar and her team, they did a virtual festival where you created an avatar and entered a space as the avatar and navigated around. That felt the most inclusive and exciting and being a part of, as you could feel in front of a laptop.
particularly with the DC one, it sounds the most interesting to me. You're getting some other type of experience. And I've seen, gosh, we've seen everything from award ceremonies, stilted, conferences, stilted, festivals, stilted. But it sounds like something that's immersive kind of changed the game a little bit and offered something completely different. Instead of just having a crutch of technology, it was actually useful.
I agree. And I think that, listen, I give everyone credit who wanted to switch to the virtual realm to save the creator's experience. We've created our wonderful films and web series and docs and everything, and we want to have them out there in the world. So in order to accommodate that, I give everyone a great deal of credit. But for me, there is a little bit of that, a lot of, not just a little bit, personal connection that you do miss. And networking, and of course, you know, the excitement of red carpets and awards, and just being able to have a cup of coffee with someone, all the social activity, all the nightlife you might get from visiting a new city. So there's a lot that you do gain by going, but some I know are going to be live. I'm going to Miami in June.
We've known this past 12 months and change to be bizarre for all of us, for the planet. Specifically, your eating habits. Has it changed the way you consume food?
Yes, I've cooked a lot more, like many people. You know, living in New York, and we're on the go. People are on the go a lot because you're on the train, you spend time at work, and you spend time out, and you're not really in your house a lot. The thing about New York City apartments, they're small. So you do spend a lot of time out of your apartment, and a lot of the time is in a restaurant or cafe or place where you can meet with someone or even bring your laptop and do work. And not cooking. Well, all of that went away. Restaurants went away. Takeout was not an option for a long time. And even after it was, I wasn't ordering, you know, from takeout. Some, a little bit here and there at times. And there was no place to really go. There's no place to go sit in a cafe and grab something anymore. It still is limited. So I started cooking a lot more. And it's been interesting. Yeah. My eating habits were not bad. I didn't have poor eating habits before, but I enjoy cooking, and I started to enjoy the time that you, a set time to prepare a meal and to sit and eat something.
It's become so, so common to hear that people are just using their kitchen more. They're getting in their hands on food more. They're learning recipes more. And that's all well and great for my purposes in this world. I love seeing people increase the number of days that they cook. But I also noticed that people went through phases, and everybody has different phases. So what were your phases of the corona times were related to food?
So after a while of the cooking, it was like, ugh, I don't want to make anything. And when the stores were open again, I'd go grab some sushi. Not every week, I'd say once every week and a half, I'd go grab a slice up the block. Like, I'm having pizza tonight, you know. And also just sometimes I've consumed a lot of broccoli this year. I mean, my broccoli consumption has like skyrocketed because I get garlic for like the well-being of it. I'd saute the garlic or I would just throw it in there. I live alone. So it'd be like, well, I got to fight off the coronavirus. I'm going to pound my system with everything that I can known to man that was supposed to be antiviral. And broccoli, olive oil.
Naturally.
Saute it in there or boil the broccoli, then throw the garlic in there, let it just heat a little bit, but not so much that it gets all the nutrients out of it. And some nights dinner would be a big thing of broccoli.
I'm not surprised at all that you went through this phase. I am surprised that it's unique. I've never heard that phase. I think it's an awesome phase because I adore broccoli.
I still buy broccoli crowns every week, and it's kind of a staple for me. It's also good if you've had a day where you've had maybe you're snacking later in the day. You know, I like to keep tortilla chips in my house. I'll eat them all. So I should say I try not to. So say you're snacking, you find yourself snacking while you're working on a project or you're doing some computer work or something. Then dinner time rolls around and you're like, oh God, now what am I going to eat? And you think now it's getting late. You don't want to eat a lot because you're going to be going to bed. Salad, a lot of kale, sauteed kale. I've made a lot of salmon in different ways. So that's been great. I love cooking salmon. And then the hunt for finding wild caught salmon in the neighborhood when the stores started having stuff was always an adventure, you know, getting a little picky.
Were you successful?
Yes. Yeah. There's a few places around that I would find it. But, you know, obviously it's more expensive, but for me, I think it's just a better piece of fish.
That is fantastic. I agree with you. I'm going to get back to the salmon in a moment because I do want to ask you a very important question that's divisive. On the broccoli, I'm finding where people have these phases that they've been approaching it like an experiment. Every iteration of broccoli, did you refine it just a little bit more? And I'm asking you that question as a precursor to what is the model today? If you were to make broccoli, what would you do differently or what would you keep the same?
I have transitioned to a different kind of salt. So I had, I think, just a regular iodized salt. And recently I picked up, I don't even know what it is. I got it from somewhere I was working, and it's larger crystals, mm-hmm. and it's really great. I like salt. I like seasoning my food. So now I'm still doing the olive oil and garlic. Rarely I was doing butter, except okay. if I was making like a cavatal or like a pasta and throwing the broccoli in there. Then I'd put a little bit of butter in there, maybe some mushrooms, that kind of thing. It has refined with... more expensive olive oil probably than I had like hanging around my cupboard before. So olive oil has, you know, pumped up a notch, and the salt has, and then making sure I have the fresh ground pepper.
That is awesome. So points for the pepper mention. But also I find it so interesting because no matter what that dish is that people have been making over and over and over again, the mere fact that more people are doing more cooking isn't the important part. It's that they're repeating the same things over and over again and refining and experimenting to get the best. You're up in your game with olive oil. You're up in your game with salts. I was having a conversation with a person named, Kevin Harrington is a stand-up comic in
yes.
Boston. And Kevin and I were talking about the fact that he went down to the rudiments of loving kosher salt. And getting back yeah. to the very basic of what it does for food. Because his point is, you could use a dozen spices, but if you don't use salt or you screw up the salt, you've ruined the dish. With salmon specifically, have you gotten to the point, and I am a proselytizer for this method, of slow roasting your salmon?
I broil it usually. And, you know, Bobby Flay says you should at a low temperature cook your salmon. You should never cook it quickly, and it should not be at a high temperature, because then the you end up ruining the flavor of it, because the fat should still be moving throughout the piece of fish or something like that. Whatever. I don't emaciate your salmon at a high temperature quickly.
Agree. Yes.
So I broil mine at a lower place, a middle level of the oven. I don't put it on that high broil setting, you know, and I have it medium rare. I don't like to cook it all the way through.
So I understand that broiling can do wonderful things as well. But so slow roasting is 250 degrees, 20 minutes. But what happens is the fish fully cooks, but what you're left with is the texture of rare.
Ooh.
Karis, you've been around the world, and I'm not going to bug you about gelato for breakfast just yet. Do you have a favorite travel food story?
I went to Sicily for the first time in my early 20s to visit. So that's where part of my heritage hails. And my mother's side, my mother's a first generation Sicilian American. Both of her parents were born in Sicily, in a small town called Lingua Glossa. I have cousins that live not too far from there in a few towns. One of them is Taormina, which you probably know, and Giardini Naxos, which is the town over from that. So we're visiting in Taormina when my cousins lived there. And it was late one night. We were looking to prepare something for dinner. You know, they tend to eat a little late sometimes. You know, like in Spain, you eat late and you're up until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then, you know, you start your day again, you know, a little bit later. We were not sure what we were going to have to eat. We didn't know it was. And so I was traveling with one of my close friends. We were, you know, girlfriends backpacking around the all of Europe. But anyway, what a time, and what a great thing to have experienced at that time. And I will never forget my cousin Santo. He just went into the kitchen and literally pulled stuff out of the refrigerator and whipped up the most delicious pasta dish. Like he was in his boxer shorts, you know, like just standing around, just like opened the refrigerator, got some homemade pasta out, threw some stuff in a pan, you know, a little bit of vegetables here and there. And suddenly we were eating this on the table. And to me, that's one of my favorite travel stories, because it was something that when I was growing up, we had dinner at a set time. Meals were planned, really great meals, because both of my parents were wonderful cooks and had such a rich heritage from their European backgrounds that food was important and essential and considered you know, life in some ways. But this was just so off the cuff. I remember just the warmth I felt with the food and connection to family and the memory of that. And just kind of being amazed by the whole scene, you know.
I love that story. And I love that story because of the word you used at the very end there, which was the setting. The scene was everything. So I could smell the kitchen, you know, your cousin hanging out in his drawers, and they're just whipping something up because they are obligated to feed you in that moment. I love stories that have that setting, and you placed it so very well. And you were.
And then on the terrace, on the balcony out the window, you peek around the corner and you can see the volcano, Mount Etna in the background, kind of like looming, you know, so just the whole thing. And this is not a food story, but a Italian heritage story. So we were having breakfast. We went earlier in the day. We're having breakfast. My cousins, Aditi and Maria, make limoncello. So they give me this. It's like 11 in the morning, and they give me this. This stuff was so strong. It was so strong. It's like one sip, and you're like, woo!
It's one of these stories. Okay. I'm ready.
So, right. Yeah, no. So, no, that was the story, is that it was another one of those wonderful, unexpected things that just hit your mouth. And knowing that she made it herself was really pretty amazing.
Okay. So since the general topic here is misguided timing of certain foods on the island of Sicily, I will now ask you, and because it's literally tied to my experience of having my first gelato and brioche for breakfast in Lingua Glossa.
Yes. Yes. In Lingua Glossa.
In Lingua Glossa. On my way to Etna, I was with a tour guide that said, hey, you know, we got to make this one stop because you got to fill the fuel tank. And he introduced us to the beauty that is brioche and gelato. And of course, a couple of espressos on our way to the volcano.
Well,
by the way, Etna did burp quite loudly when we were on the hike.
Wow.
So tell me about this gelato for breakfast thing, because I demystify it for me.
I don't know if I know enough about the history of where that came from. I do know that it was the first thing that when I landed in Taormina off the train, it was the first place, even before going to their home, it was the first thing they did with us, a gelato espresso shop, and we had gelato brioche with cappuccino or espresso shot. You want me to demystify it? It's one of the best things you could ever eat to start your day.
I have asked so many Italian friends this very question.
And what did they say?
I have yet to have an answer other than, hey, come on. How do you not eat bread and ice cream?
You're talking about the Italians. You're talking about people that love life. You're talking about, you know, la vita dolce. You're talking about people who embrace everything. And food is such a huge part of that. Yeah. So why not?
I honestly think that's the only answer that I'll ever get.
It's like art, Howie. Come on. It's a piece of art, right?
And you do it, and you do it because you can.
When I was in Bilbao, Spain, for the Bilbao Web Fest, great food, you know, because you've been all over Spain. So just fantastic. And they have these things called pinchos, which are like crostini, but better because they're so flavorful and there's so many different interesting kinds and they're huge. You know, so you need one or two as a meal. And I love bacalao. And I was literally searching for bacalao crostini when I was in Bilbao. Great festival, by the way, a little plug. I traveled from Bilbao day after the festival just to take a little side trip to San Sebastian. And I was walking through the town and there was this place that had the largest display of these pinchos I've ever seen. It was like long tables of these things prepared. And so for people who don't know, it's bread with certain kind of, I won't say toppings, it's like a meal on top of the bread. They were just beautiful. I stopped, I took a picture. I mean, it was just amazing to look at. It's just the attention that people pay to food. Food is a work of art in you know, obviously all around the world, many places.
And you do have to wonder why very few other cultures picked up this hundreds and hundreds of slices of baguette topped with sundry seafoods and meats and cheeses and charcuterie, all secured with a skewer or the pincho, right? So the pincho is the name for the toothpick, if you will, that goes through the stuff on top. There's a layer of sauce, and then there's a vegetable, and then there's a pickled something, and then there's an olive, and then they, boom, all together with one stick. And this is a note, the next time you go back to San Sebastian, or Bilbao for that matter, pinchos are all over that north part of the coast. All the things on the bar are fantastic. And you can find them in most pincho bars, right? You've got your hams and your peppers and all this
on top, and fish,
absolutely, yeah, on top of the bread, like the bacalao. There are also hot pinchos that come out of the kitchen instead of being on the bar. And let me tell you, these hot ones are special. They're, you know, life-altering. A hunk of bluefin tuna seared with a torch, an equal-sized hunk of foie gras seared on top of the tuna and drizzled with unagi sauce. Do you know what unagi sauce is? It's the sauce they put on the grilled eel and some microgreens on top of it. I had a little pincho whisperer in a server named Ines. And Ines, she's like, don't take food off the bar just yet. Hold on. Wait for the hot stuff to come out of the kitchen. Your eyes are bigger than your stomach necessarily. You walk in and if you just take food off the bar, you're going to fill up very quickly. But if you wait for the hot stuff, it's worth it. I love Bilbao and St. Sebastian. St. Sebastian is, if not Barcelona, I would move to St. Sebastian in a heartbeat. When we first arrived, I had tweeted just a tweet to Chef Jose Andres.
Do you know him?
I do not know him, but I need to know him. But he was very responsive to a tweet to say, hey, where should I eat in San Sebastian? It was great.
That's incredible. What did he tell you?
Two places, Ostalena and Gambara.
I will go.
Wait for the hot dishes to come out.
So my first trip to the Bilbao Web Fest with the Pepper Project, I rented a room, like an Airbnb type situation. Lovely couple that were expecting a baby, and it was just a little bit up main area of town. Beautiful room, a lot of space, and you open these old shutters out onto the street. Just completely picturesque, and just my heart was so full. I'm so in love with the whole experience. But she had prepared for me on a dish just the loveliest display of some fresh fruit and some nuts and a hard-boiled egg and some whole grain bread. Wow. And with jam that was delicious, like an apricot jam. The way that she had everything prepared was just such lovely attention to detail and care that's part of what I remember associated with that meal. And every morning, I was there for 4 or 5 days. Every morning was something like that. It was an experience to remember waking up and looking at that, you know?
To me, that is much more, and probably in your mind as well, but it's much more about Spanish hospitality than it is the food. And the reason I say that is because that is a very non-Spanish way to breakfast. One of the things that took me by surprise when moving to Spain was that they cook so much with eggs, but they do not ever consider it as a breakfast food.
I do a potatoes and eggs, or I do have eggs other times of the day.
Yeah.
I don't, just because I do love eggs and there's many things that you can do with them.
But it's associated with breakfast
here.
Right.
Correct.
Right. It's such a non-Spanish way of thinking that is pure hospitality. Do you have a worst food travel story?
So I was in Mexico at Maya Tulum, which is a yoga retreat resort. It's eco-friendly, so very kind of, I don't want to say bare bones because it's lovely, but it's very simple. And you're literally in a hut on the beach. What could be better? But one of the women I met, she, you know, you're not supposed to drink the water. I don't know if she brushed her teeth. I don't know what she did. She was so sick. And it ruined half her trip. I mean, it was terrible. She really was laid up and had to get to the doctor somewhere in remote Tulum beachside Mexico, which is why I always try to travel with a Cipro.
Is that the Cipro, the stuff that was the household name when people were sending anthrax through the mail, right? Cipro was the answer?
I don't know. I don't think it's related. I don't know if it's related to that. But if I have said the wrong name of the medication, forgive me.
No. I also took Cipro when I was when I went to Africa. I did not, but I thought that I got sick, so that I proactively took Cipro.
Yeah, the past couple trips I've taken, I've had the doctor, you know, get a prescription for, just to preempt it, because if you're on the beach in Mexico without it, forget it. Your trip is ruined. So.
Look out, right? You're taking out whatever week vacation you have. You're chopping it in half. Did this person perhaps make the assumption or the leap of faith that because it was a kind of an advanced intellectual type of vacation, that the water may have been filtered?
You know what? I actually think it could have been ice in a drink even. It's more food related because it might be ice that it was the culprit.
That counts. Ice counts as food. Yes. This is the part of the show Garris, where we do five fill in the blanks. Blank will be my last meal.
I have to say lasagna, and that's only because it just came to my head, but that would be it.
Okay, lasagna is a very, very large canvas. What's your go-to
just
lasagna?
Ricotta cheese. I don't need vegetable in it. I just want ricotta cheese, some meatballs, like my mother would make, sauce, layered, and grated cheese.
So you'd say you're more of the ground beef versus ground sausage in a lasagna?
Yes. Yeah, I would say.
Okay. That's fair. Because I've got my issues with sausage inside of lasagna.
It overwhelms the lasagna.
It overwhelms the lasagna. It's no longer lasagna. It's a sausage boat. Next question.
Okay.
I cook blank to impress people.
I cook nothing to impress people. I haven't had anyone over to eat in over like a year plus now.
It's a really weird question to ask during this era. Okay, let me ask it slightly differently. In your dreams, you have a guest in your home and you're going to cook them what to make them happy?
I would say a homemade sauce with pasta.
So are you a sugo person or are you a marinara person? What's your sauce?
These days, marinara. I just have time to fry meat and make, the veal, pork, and beef meatballs. And then you got to do all that. You know, not that there's anything wrong with that, but if you've got 9 hours to do it, that's great. In a big kitchen. I have a very tiny space, so it's hard to cook.
I cook blank to comfort myself.
I will say there's nothing like a nice dish of macaroni when you just need to settle in and have something warm and comforting, you know. And my mom does not like to have any vegetable, anything green with pasta. Like she wouldn't have a salad with the pasta. She wouldn't have broccoli, like any sort of, she just wants her pasta and that's it. And I've come to be like that a little bit. It's just like, I just want a dish of pasta. That's all. Just simple and lovely and comforting.
I grew up in a house where it was actually a thing. I believe it was my mother who did this most of all, but some of her cousins and aunts and uncles as well. And as you know, from an Italian family, they may or may not have been blood relatives.
It didn't. You know what? It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. But my mother would have her salad after her pasta and actually, you know, utilize right. The scarpetta of the sauce that's left on the plate as sort of a dressing. I guess it was a thing. I mean, it's fascinating. A lot of people
think you would have the salad after the pasta because the oil and the vinegar would help you digest the meal. So it'd be the last thing you ate because of that.
Yeah.
You start with the meat, then you'd have the pasta, then you'd have the salad.
But on top of the leftover sauce is an interesting method, I think.
It's too messy for me. I don't want all that.
This next question is divisive.
Kick me off the program.
No, I get into fights over this question.
Oh, no.
Here it is. The one food I would erase from the earth is blank.
Tripe.
Tripe.
The stomach lining of the cow or something.
Of a just bovine. Right.
Disgusting. But it's a delicacy. Like, isn't there anything else you could choose? You're going to eat that?
I might actually, this. I don't think this is going to cause a fight because I think I agree with you.
Ah, see? So you could probably defend a lot.
Tripe is not one of my, in fact, offal in general, not one of my go-to things. I will say that. I have had tripe done in a fantastic way, and that was delicious. But I wouldn't argue with getting rid of it. Blank is for dinner tonight.
Sushi.
Ooh, you surprised me. I thought it was going to be eggs or pasta. What's the Vucek sushi order?
Oh, very simple from the grocery store. Like I do not like extensive sushi stuff. I don't like a lot of raw fish, but I like the rolls. So I like the spicy tuna roll or the salmon roll with avocado, something simple.
How do you feel about tamago? Tamago is the egg omelet. You could have egg for dinner tonight by adding it to your sushi order to see if they have tamago nigiri. I'm just saying, if you were interested in getting egg into this meal, you could do it.
Oh.
This has been really wonderful. I really appreciate your time. You are quite busy these days.
Trying to be. Good to be back out celebrating with friends and food where we can.
And we will get back to that bonfire. That I promise.
I hope so. I look forward to it.
Okay. We'll see you later.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
To all of you wonderful, intelligent listeners out there, remember to subscribe to this show, follow me on Instagram, and find our books with your favorite seller. Those are One Pan to Rule Them All, Kiss My Casserole, How to Cook Anything in Your Dutch Oven, Chinese Street Food, and the forthcoming Off the Top of My Head, Recipes, Rants, and Ravings of an American Cook Obsessing in Barcelona. Until next time, stay saucy and eat well.